So I was looking through the Mumonkan, the gateless gate, and came upon this quite interesting case, number 23, Wei Neng, neither good nor evil. The case. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Taiyu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bow, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Wang Mei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can say that, then let us both call Huang Mei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." Wu Men's comment. It must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He is like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it into your mouth. Then you only need to swallow it down. Wu Men's verse. It can't be described, it can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. So already our third day of practice. Actually, not the third. Already our last full day. The Buddha's teaching is that all things fall apart. One of his last teachings that he gave to Ananda, his beloved disciple. All things fall apart. Proceed with care. So we have been participating on this retreat in falling apart. For us humans, often more easy to participate in the gathering and the rising and the fullness, and some reluctance to die. A wonderful cartoon I remember of a tree in the fall, the first frame, it's all the leaves are there. In the second frame, some have fallen. The third frame, all of them have fallen except one. And the final frame, this one leaf is falling down, and it goes, "Ah!" We are all that one leaf. And this falling, this wonderful image that has been with us, that Julie gave us as a present, as a koan, this human life is just one great fall. And so we are learning how to fall. We are learning how to disappear. And this wonderful line, it must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. Reminds me, of course, of Dogen's wonderful teaching that to study the way is to study the self. When we begin, we think we are studying out something outside of us, trying to find something. But then we realize, as he goes on, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And like all Zen aphorisms or instructions, it sounds easy. Oh, just let go. Just forget yourself. But any action you take to forget yourself reinforces the self. I will set out and I will be the one who forgets myself. Great, I did a good job of that. And the self reifies itself. And this little self, this precious karmic incarnation, this troublesome self, this unbounded self, this wounded self, this particular self, this is the Buddha. This is the Buddha appearing in this vast universe. The universe appearing as you. We say the true Dharma body is the entire universe. And when we get out of our head, when we stop trying to figure things out, I think it's when we begin to sense there's something more interesting than ourselves. And this is quite a feat for human beings, because we are quite fascinated by ourselves, quite fascinated with this story of who, what, and when, and where I came from, and what's going to happen. But so in one sense we say, of course, I think it was Melissa or someone said that more channels in your mind than you could ever get on cable. But when you look closely, it's just like cable. When you look closely at all the channels, there's nothing new. Right? You flip through, well, maybe this, no, maybe that. And so here on retreat, we flip through all the channels. Hoping to get a good Buddhist channel. Oh yeah, got the Buddhist channel now. This is great. But we see that the Buddhist channel has been taken over by the little self, who just wants to get something. It's all it knows how to do. I want something, I want. And so, we flip through all the channels. We, cycle through the 10,000 things. And slowly, very slowly for some of us, we begin to see, oh, this is just more of the same. And even when I get what I want, the gratification is so fleeting. And then the great wanting arises again. And then we want to get rid of the wanting, and we work hard on that. So what is this forgetting ourself? This is when we begin to actually notice our breath. When we begin to feel our feet on the floor, this activity of Zen is not an abstract intellectual activity. And many of us came to Zen because of the beauty of the abstraction and the worldview. quite a wonderful thing, and I'm quite pleased myself that through mindfulness and through other movements in our world, some of these teachings of be yourself, just be here, are beginning to be promulgated. But of course, the teachings of Buddhism, as we pursue this path, are simply another impediment, something else to hold on to. And these teachings, we say, are the finger pointing at the moon. And the moon is the liveliness of life itself. And it is possible as we slow down, as we come into this stillness as best we can, as we return to our practice, return to our breath, return to just letting everything be, return to our inquiry, our koan. As we return again and again, we can begin to give ourself, rather than looking to hold back and to get something. We begin to see it is possible to give ourself, to give our life. And we are asked to give our life. We are ultimately required. This life you have, this body, are just on loan, just temporary. You do not own this. The bank will foreclose, will repossess, and you will give away everything you have. You will give away your health. You will give away your great insight. You will give away your competence, and you and I will disappear. And it is this disappearing that we so are afraid of. What if I'm nobody? And as we come into the moment and we begin to see that we cannot not actually find the person who is walking, we cannot find the one who is breathing, who is eating her food, that we come into this world of freedom. That when we forget ourselves, when we are so intimate with what is here that there is no one keeping score, then whatever is appearing, whether it is conflict, whether it is peacefulness, all of this we enter into. This is the great activity of shigyo practice, of dying, not as some kind of romantic enterprise, the latest romantic quest of the ego. Okay, now I have to die. Let me stage my death. No, this is something that comes from love, comes from the willingness to give ourselves to what we love. And we all love life beyond measure. And whether we remember that or not makes no difference. There is in this beating heart some great love. And we encounter that love, we encounter this appreciation. As we forget ourselves in the activity of this moment. And so Dogen says to study the self is to forget the self, to forget the self is to be awakened by all things. And these all things come to meet us right here and right now.
This falling apart. What arose for me when I heard those words was how often in my life, what is arising is that the thought and the belief that I must hold it all together. I must hold all of myself together. I must hold my family together. Whatever it is that I perceive is falling apart in that moment. This story, this belief of I must hold it together. And this practice has offered me another option to fall apart. To show my heart, my brokenheartedness, my sadness, my concern, my care, my love, this belief and thought that I must hold it together, born of love for what it is that I am trying to save. And this great practice of entrusting myself to the awakened heart, that my idea of keeping it all together is good and that falling apart is bad. Meeting that, seeing that. And I find that in this wonderful koan that David discovered and brought to us this morning, just in the title alone. Don't think neither good nor bad? Yes, neither good nor evil. Neither good nor evil. And then it's mentioned again, this exchange between Huineng and Ming. And Huineng says, don't think good. Don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk? And this line, this don't think good, don't think evil, has been with me. And it's so easy to hear this as a thing that we must do. Okay, now I have to figure out how to don't think good, don't think evil. And if I could just figure that out. And we often hear this in other chants too. Let your fond opinions go. Set your preferences aside. And we think, yeah, how do I do that? How do I do that? I want to do that so much. And I think that Huineng is pointing to something different than that. I think Huineng understands that that ridding ourselves of preferences would be quite impossible. This don't think good, don't think evil. One way I hear that now after this week of looking at this koan is that this is something I do all the time. This separating into good and bad, right and wrong, okay, not okay, embarrassed, not embarrassed. It's like it's built into my DNA, it feels sometimes. And certainly comes to me in a way that feels automatic. Perhaps something I've learned, and in some way quite useful. The world is a complicated place. Lots and lots going on out there. And putting things into categories has its use. in not in allowing me to navigate the world and my life without constantly being overwhelmed. And yet, the Wei Nong, I think, is actually encouraging me here to realize that, yeah, this can happen automatically, Laura. This is something that if you are able to see when it arises, oh, right, there I am, separating things again. Good and evil. Embarrassed, not embarrassed. Good Zen student, bad Zen student. And I think in this line he's encouraging me to set that down when possible. And in this setting it down, this falling apart, not needing to put it all into a certain place, taking the risk of having things not quite be what I thought they were, or what I thought they should be, or think they should be, how they should go. It's quite a risk, actually, to trust and entrust ourselves to this great boundlessness that we are in free fall in. However things are falling apart, that is, in fact, what's happening. And to entrust that. To set aside these stories I have of myself, of the one who should be able to hold it all together. The one who desperately wants to hold it all together. The one that is sure that holding it all together is the right thing to do. To see those stories and to be in this free fall of not knowing, whether holding it together is the right thing or not. And allowing this great universe and us, this infinite boundlessness, that is constantly arising, regardless of my little mind, to come forward in all various unpredictable and surprising ways. And then to meet that each moment, fresh and new, how quickly I cover it up with these stories. Each time, brand new, this dying to ourselves over and over, being reborn over and over. The Zen and Shin priest Mioe, he has a beautiful line that I carry with me. He says, everything is a temporary assemblage. The body, a temporary assemblage, assembling and falling apart in each moment. Everything falling apart. Please sit comfortably. And, as we have been doing, everyone is invited to come forward in this Dharma dialogue. and come from around the back of the fireplace to hear Ben. Caden.
My first reaction was, oh God, no, he's gone. And the thing that's stuck with me today was Wayne putting down the golden bowl. Mm-hmm. And he's been doing that every day. For this poem, I'm like, oh, that's what I keep doing, is putting
lovely, thank you.
It's so nice that he's been doing it every day. And I think one of the things we really value in Zen is repetition. Mm-hmm. Right? There's some way, most of your life, well, you do it and you check the box. We check the same box every day. What's next? Oh, more sitting. Oh, and then after that, what do? Oh, let's do more sitting. But in this repetition with this spirit, and sometimes it's like, oh no, not one more time. But then we begin to see, oh, the repetition of breathing in and out is the most precious repetition in the world. And we begin to, oh yeah, let me put it down one more time. Yes. Thank you.
Adam.
Thank you. This new koan that we've been studying for, what, 3-4 kalpas has really touched me this week. And this session, I think, coming into it, I told myself not to have any expectations, of Sashin, which, of course, just fueled the Ming engine. And then I had all these ideas, like, maybe the bird will beat its wings just the right way, or maybe the sparrows will help the woodpecker. Maybe the porta-potties will smell like flowers. The thing that Laura was just alluding to, the brokenheartedness, the trusting, of the heart, we've used the language before, cracking open or bursting open, is something that I wanted to avoid in my practice. Mm-hmm. And, I think somebody mentioned the other day, like, oh, if there's a problem, I just fix it. That I saw that as something I could fix, or I could devise some strategy to get around it, or see things as really beautiful, and then the brokenheartedness would just sort of not be there, or something like that. But turning toward it and just letting it happen, whether it's anger or guilt or sadness or feeling alone or something like that, is really touched me here, and I've been moved to tears pretty much every day. Sorry to break the stereotypes there, the social conditioning in me wants to apologize for crying, and kind of learned that maybe there's no more eloquent expression of the dharma, just crying. It's better than anything that I muster with words. So, thank you.
And thank you so much for crying when crying arises. So much conditioning for many of us to cut it off right here. We can feel it coming up, and then it's got to stop. And I love what someone said the other day. I can't remember who, about it, that what we're doing here actually goes against the grain. And there's something in one of the chants that we spoke today about our habits, grinding down and letting them fall apart. Letting those habits fall apart. And
you know, the sort of bringing together a few things, this also this idea of repetition, repeating crying day after day, repeating the sits, repeating the koan. And it's funny because every time we do it, it's actually completely brand new and fresh. And we get the idea that this is, I'm just doing the same thing again. But when we actually live into it in practice, it's never the same at all. It was just the idea that it was the same. And so there's also the idea that, oh, if I do this, then I can check off the box. That I won't have to do it again. Now that I had my crying sashin, next sashin. That box was checked. Yeah. You know, the possibility of our just learning to, I mean, maybe, really, we don't know what will come. But it could also be that we end up having a crying sashin every retreat. Who knows? We don't know. So we think it's the same, or that it will be, or we want it to be, or I'm prepared for it to be the same, and then it's not. You know, really, coming back to your point about we just don't know. And so it's great to throw ourselves on the cushion. You know, I've mentioned this before, like for me, the great koan, right? The two sort of Korean koans in that tradition, the Hwado of who am I and what is this? These questions. Years and years and years of asking, what is this? What is this? It's never the same.
Stephen.
So I'm struck by a couple of things that came up from listening to this today. You know, the first thing is the sixth ancestor forgets himself, you know. Like if he remembers himself, he would have been, my book, right? But he forgets himself. And then the robe and bowl are laid on the rock. And someone mentioned the other day, you know, the robe and bowl being empty, but it's on the rock. You know, and to me, the image that comes up is, you know, the seated Buddha hand touching the ground. You know, this is the sword of Manjushri that kills and gives life, the sword of wisdom. And, you know, this forgetting the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Just Bob, did you want to?
No.
When you mentioned the sword of Manjushri, I thought of cutting through delusion. You know, cutting through these ideas are that we have about who we are. This self that keeps appearing in all its various forms, right? And you speak of stillness. Kevin.
And sort of something that's been bubbling up for a couple days now is people are giving Wu Mao a lot of credit for putting down the robe and bowl, and sort of we love to talk about Ming as being deluded and going to pick it up, but Wu Mao tells him to. He says, this robe represents the Dharma. So he's sort of, he's supposed to be the enlightened one, but it feels like he's sort of like tricking Ming into like, this, here's the Dharma. Come get it. Fight over it, just come get it. And then, you know, Ming follows the instruction of the teacher and he's like, ha ha, no, you can't do that. And something that hit me as David was talking about, and before on the retreat and before that, Laura was talking about like, oh, enlightenment's not going to be this flashbulb moment. It's not going to be this amazing thing. even though all the stories say it's great Satori, it's never just like, you know, sort of Satori. and so I sort of was taking that to heart and, oh, this, okay, so maybe just this. And then David is speaking in all these like wonderful, just beautiful terms, and then that makes me doubt, like, oh, wait a minute. So that sort of that feeling like, oh, here, come get it. No, just kidding.
We have some dokes on trauma here.
You know, it's kind of wonderful if you really pay attention to our teachings of the masters of the past. There's continual contradiction, right? It just, so it's this, but it's really not this. And it's not this, but it's really this. Over and over and over and over again. And partly that's because we can only point to it. We can't actually talk about it with any sense of accuracy. So, you know, Dogen is a master of this. He'll say, it's this, and it's not this. And it's both this and not this, and it's neither this or, and not this, and by the end you're going, whoa! But he's actually being very accurate. And these teachings go back to India. They're called the four propositions. You know, this, not this. Both this and not this. Neither this nor not this. And if you try to follow it at a certain point, your brain just goes... This thing about sometimes awakening is just, and sometimes it's, it's true. It's absolutely true. Every, you know, we had blueberries this morning for breakfast. I don't know if anybody had any, but boy, if we just think blueberry, Satori, or blueberry, whoa! But it's actually each blueberry reveals itself. If we're really paying attention, nothing is the same. And every human being is different. And, you know, Julie talked last night about the comparing mind. So strong, so pervasive. And we compare ourselves to these guys. And what you're doing is you're seeing through something, the bait and switch of the teaching. I was saying before, when Caden said the thing about repeating, there's a certain point, for those of you who are working with koans, some of you get to this point where you know, I used to come in and think, oh, great, I'm going to solve this guy, got the koan, it's great. And there's this great moment where the teacher said, yes. And then I get another koan. Wait a minute. Is there no end? And then we think, oh, yeah, the curriculum ends. But it actually doesn't. It goes on and on and on and on until that very last breath. So it's important to see the value of repetition in seeing through repetition, as we've been talking about. Every blueberry unique, right? Every blade of grass has the Buddhist teachings written on it. Very different every time.
Also, Kevin, I want to appreciate the kind of come get the yeah. And then he can't lift it up. And in some ways, it may look like a bait and switch, but we don't need teachers to bait us. We bait ourselves, right? We all come in with these strategies. Well, I'm just going to be diligent, and I'm going to lift this thing up and power my way through it, right? And then we say to each other, go ahead, keep trying, see how it works. Because it's only by seeing our own strategies fail that we get to a point of saying, okay, fallen apart. Now what's here? Right? So it was only by trying again, I think, that Ming, you know, and realizing, oh God, this just isn't working, that Ming finally is able to say, okay, what's here? And he's able to be open to what comes next.
Yes, oh, and then Meredith.
I guess I've been thinking about, you know, we talk a lot about arising, and it always seems like that's a good thing. Yeah, at least that was sort of the way my mind was taking it. You know, just watch what's arising. It's just arising. And I see that. I got some of that. But as I was listening to the talks, I was trying to hold really still, and man, my knees were really starting to hurt. And I thought, just don't know. Can I adjust position like right in the middle of the teisho, or am I not supposed to? If I could just stop, then I could really, you know, there's something important. And I just realized then that in a way, one of the sides of the problem for me is I feel like, yeah, okay, so the universe is constantly giving. It's giving. But that's a problem. My hands are full. What am I going to do with all this? I've got too much. Now, I can't take the knee pain on top of these words and your thoughts about what David said before and everything I'm supposed to be doing. It's too much. It's too much. And then I thought of dying, and I thought, the blessing is that it all goes away instantly. Mm. You do have to take it, but then it all goes away. You don't have to just keep adding stuff. Mm. And that just came so, like, such a great thought. I mean, it was still hard. My leg still hurt, and I didn't like it. To me, that the moment-by-moment passing away is the only thing that makes all the arising okay.
Because the arising has a companion.
Yeah. Because otherwise, it's going to pile up.
Yeah. Way too much. Way too much.
Yeah. Ah, that's... This
rising
is the,
and falling away. Rising and falling away.
Yeah. The piling up is where you caught me. If I didn't be right in, you know, with that compelling me to speak. This piling up, and you know what I see when I in my practice is that it's not piling up. I'm piling it up. You know, in my mind, I'm trying to, as you were talking about, so I have to hold that my knee hurts, and then I have to hold that this is happening with my family, or, you know, for myself personally, and then this is happening, and then that's it, and then I have to remember the words that David said so that I can make some kind of, like talk that goes with it, and, you know, and I'm like, my head's going, thank goodness, it just, like, finally gets to be, I can't hold it all.
Yeah.
There's 8 billion things coming at me. And what can I hold? 8 of them?
There's a study that says that.
Yeah. Yeah.
8 billion things, but you can only hold 8 at the most.
At the most.
In any moment.
Yeah, thank you. And sometimes I really can only hold 1. You know, which seems to be most moments I can hold one. And what a relief, actually.
Well, and this teaching of rising and falling away, rising and falling away, the arising happens by itself and the falling away happens by itself. We're not in charge, right? We just heard that teaching.
Yeah.
We are not in charge of it. It's unbelievable. How could that be? We don't even have to, you know, I've been thinking about, so we say that, that when we get caught in a state, that like a hell realm, we try to get out of it, but we dig ourselves in deeper. If we just turn towards it and be with the suffering, it self-releases. We don't do it. And I was thinking about my spam folder. It's the same thing. Once it gets to 100, it empties itself. You know, I don't do it. I every day I empty my spam folder, but then when I'm away, I don't see my spam folder. And when I come back, it's only got 100 items in it. How is that possible? But they're different items. Mm. It self-releases.
Mm. I'm going to relabel my spam folder. Hell realm.
I think the whole Gmail could really be renamed that.
Well, and that this self-releasing and dying may not be different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right? That you know, we have constructed, as you say, rising good, falling bad. Life good, death bad. But there is only life and death. There is not life. Right? Life and death. And the great freedom. Yeah.
Yes, Meredith.
When I fantasize myself into this story as we name, it unfolds in a slightly different way. It has David playing the role of Hungren. So he gives me the bowl and the robe, and he closes his eyes that way he does when he's looking into your soul. And he says, "The Sangha will kill you." And I say,
Yes, yes, participation in the Sangha, death of the self. Right, got that. He said, no, we've got to get you out of here. And he drives me down, he drives me across Massachusetts to the Hudson River in the middle of the night. And why we don't just take one of the bridges, I don't know, but he drives down and we get into a little rowboat. And he rows me across the Hudson River. I live in White Plains, which is near that river. That's a prominent river for me. And halfway across, he says, let me see your cell phone. And he throws that in the river. And we get to the other side, and he says, go home. Tell your wife that the Boundless Way Sangha is coming for you. She'll know what to do. And then he rows back away. And as he's going, I say, but I actually live on the East Bank. He says, I know. So my version of the story simply just it leaves me there. That what I get is rowed across this river and stranded without cell phone on the far side of a river from where home is, and left to my own devices from there. Nothing but a big river between me, well, a big river and several miles between me and home.
And I do think this is the Zen teacher's job, to leave you stranded. Right? Because to do anything else would be stealing your treasure.
Yeah. So, and my cell phone.
Yeah. But to, you know, I hope that we confuse and provoke and disturb you and leave you high and dry, because we are all high and dry. We are all on the wrong side of the river, not knowing what to do. No problem.
So, thank you, everyone.